Go ahead. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Chris Cook alongside me, Alan Buck. It's Game Day IQ at thegrillingtruth.com, the Thursday evening tradition. We are back. Alan Buck, say hello to everybody this evening.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry we've been off for a few weeks. Work schedules and things just have precluded us from having this opportunity. But we're back, and we're a little iced in. So everything, it doesn't take much to do that in our neck of the woods, but this is a pretty serious one, at least for a day or until we get the roads cleared.
Most serious one we've had since the 2009 ice storm. I know I'm getting old when I say, you remember the ice storm of 2009.
Yeah, and I can reel off a few more that you weren't even around for. So let's not talk about age here. But yeah, this, I tell you, it's beautiful out there. That's the one thing. I know ice is treacherous and could cause problems, but it is pretty. But anyway, hey, let's look here at Game Day IQ, where, as always, we're going to bring you some stories from the sports world that you probably have not heard. And even the most ardent of sports fans usually will have their game day IQs raised while listening to our show. Today's no different, as we share stories from the worlds of tennis, boxing, baseball, football, hockey, auto racing, and so much more. So stay tuned and see if our information doesn't help you win some trivia contests somewhere down the road. And along the way, see if you might share a birthday with any of the sports stars whose careers we celebrate.
Absolutely.
What do you think about that, Chris? Sound like we got a show on tap?
Sounds like we got one ready to go.
Tell you, before we go into any birthdays, let's go to our golden nugget of information corner department. And this I learned a few things about this. Let's talk about the 1973 tennis match between the 55-year-old former men's world number one player Bobby Riggs and the current, at that time, number one ranked woman Billie Jean King. I'm sure you all have heard a little bit about it. King has been featured on this show and occupies a prominent place in our Ones Who Came Before wing at the Palatial Fox Sports Evansville studio. But that match between Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King was dubbed the Battle of the Sexes. And as I said, in 1973, that was kind of the era, you know, Battle of the Sexes was prominent all over the place. Women's lib movement was in full swing, and there was a lot of competition between the sexes and everything from equal pay and equal opportunities to just the littlest things in our daily lives. Well, that match and much of the hullabaloo surrounding it is fairly common knowledge in the sporting world, but there are two things which I think are going to raise your game day IQ, and possibly that of my co-host here, Mr. Cook. He wasn't quite born yet at that time. But the second thing, which I'm going to give first, so maybe it should be called the first thing, but it occurred chronologically second of these two points. Since his tennis playing career ended, Bobby Riggs had spent much time promoting tennis and himself, really. He felt the female game was inferior to the men's game, and in 1973 he became more vocal about this point. But here's the part that few people know. He had challenged Billie Jean King, but she declined. Then Margaret Court stepped up to the plate. Court was 30 at the time and was enjoying a 7-year run as the year-end world number one. Well, Riggs used a drop shot approach, which made his opponent run more, and it saved his 55-year-old legs. Riggs won that match 6-2, 6-1. Well, after that, it was open season for Riggs to taunt all female tennis players. So King came to the rescue in a nationally televised $100,000 that's $576,000 in today's dollars, winner-take-all event. It was one of those made-for-TV things that we've seen over the years, and ad nauseum, really. But this one had the significance of being the battle between the sexes. The match was held at the Houston Astrodome. That was back when it was considered the sixth wonder of the world. You may have heard of it, Chris, before they tore it down.
Yeah. No, I remember. It was it's where they played in one of the Bad News Bears movies, you know. That's how that was my first insight into the Houston Astrodome.
There we go. It brings it to a whole new generation. Well, King had earned her fifth year-ending number one ranking that the year before and was number two behind Court in 1973. King had paid close attention to the Riggs Court match, so she was prepared for Riggs' tactics. King fell behind early, but then buckled down in this quote-unquote must-win situation. Instead of attacking, which was King's style, she stayed at the baseline. Easily handling Riggs' lobs and soft shots, she chased him all over the court, in effect, beating him at his own game. King won the match 6-4, 6-3, 6-3. Now, here is the first thing, and I will bet that very, very few people know this. Maybe Mike Baugh, a tennis pro down in Florida, he might know this. In 1939, 21-year-old Bobby Riggs was an amateur tennis player, and he was the number one ranked player in the world. He would not go pro until 1941. So listen to this. Sit down. You're going to want to get this, folks. Especially if you're driving, you'll want to sit down. Bobby Riggs went to Wimbledon and won the men's singles. Riggs, teaming with men's runner-up Elwood Cook, also won the men's doubles. Riggs also teamed with women's singles champion Alice Marble and won the mixed doubles. Bobby Riggs is one of only three men to win all three Wimbledon championships in the same year. One of only three men to do that. I thought he was just kind of a crackpot loudmouth when he was, you know, doing his antics in 1973. But as a 21-year-old amateur, he did that. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I'll go from memory, I think Don Budge did that twice. And there was one other gentleman, I don't remember his name, but Bobby Riggs is one of only three men to win all three Wimbledon championships in the same year. And incidentally, Alice Marble did the same for women that year. It's done. Huh. It's been done nine times by women, including twice by Billie Jean King herself. But there you have it. I know some game day IQs got raised in the world of tennis.
And I'll tell you, I
yeah, go ahead.
You just raised everybody's by at least a point. And that's our goal week in and week out when we do the show, is to try to make you a little bit smarter when it comes to game day stuff.
I think I'll have to send Mike Baugh a little note about this and see if he knew that.
Hmm.
He's pretty sharp. He happened to spend a little time with us in the semi-pro football league back in when Chris and I met, when he was protecting my son's life. as the center to my son quarterback. But anyway, we'll see how Mr. Ball's knowledge goes. But here, let's go also from the golden nugget of information center. The NFL began recording, so we're in the world of football now. The NFL began recording sacks in 1982, okay, and has been noted on this show, the late, great Deacon Jones of the Los Angeles Rams predated this era, but probably created the urgency to keep track of this game-changing statistic. He also might be the career leader, but we'll never know. But following is a rundown of what we do know regarding the top 10 team sack leaders since 1982. Okay? Teams, not individuals. Take some shots, Chris. Just start naming a few, and I'll tell you where they rank if you get them. And this starting in 82, so obviously some of these newer franchises are not going to be included.
I would say the Giants.
They are number six.
You got to think of sack people. So the Bears.
Number four.
The Baltimore Ravens.
They're too new, remember?
Oh. I didn't know if they were going to count like the Cleveland stuff before then. My fault. I should have asked for clarification.
Oh, yeah, I would have told you that. That's a real good point, Chris. Yeah, that is a real good point. I bet they might have been included had we done it that way, but they didn't. It's just straight up names, no crossovers.
Philadelphia Eagles.
Number one, Chris, you're doing fantastic.
Yeah.
Number two, I think will be a dark horse. I don't know. Just name a few more, and I'll probably end up giving you two.
Number two, if the Eagles and the, it wouldn't be the Cowboys because they really don't sack a lot.
True. No, they sit back and defend, unless of course they're playing the Steelers, in which case they don't defend. sorry.
Oh,
folks,
I don't know. Would it be somebody
the
like the, you know, if we're talking from 1982 on, would it be the Broncos maybe?
The Broncos are number seven. We'll fill in the gaps here, folks. Chris, you did terrific. You got 5 out of 10, including the number one horse. Number two is the New Orleans Saints. I would never have picked them. Number three, and this is a little after their heyday, but still, the Pittsburgh Steelers, number three. Then the Bears, four. Number five, the Minnesota Vikings. That would have been in the Eller, Marshall, Page, Larson era. So that would have covered them. Then you got the Giants, six. The Broncos, seven. Number eight, the San Francisco 49ers. Number nine, the Rams, wherever they're located. And then number 10, the Raiders, also wherever they're located. But I thought that was interesting to look, and some of these teams obviously, you know, not necessarily in, like, had they started keeping that track in the 70s, the Steelers probably would be number one because they, you know, in the, through the 70s with the four Super Bowl champions, they had a tremendous front four. The Rams, of course, would have had to go back to the 60s doing, you know, when Deacon Jones and the rest of the fearsome foursome were doing the sacking. But anyway, thought we'd throw that out there and you know, nothing extraordinary that people are going to remember, but it just kind of makes you go, huh, I didn't know that. So anyway, let's look at some birthdays. And start January 1, New Year's Day. Here's one from 1857. Tim Keith. He passed away in 1933. The reason I brought him up, he was elected Major League Baseball Hall of Fame in 1964. He was a dominant pitcher of the 19th century, pitching from 1880 through 1893. He holds the all-time record for single-season ERA at 0.86 in 1880. Now, I know we're throwing asterisks all over this one, but that was the last season in which pitcher – how'd you like the way I phrased that?
Yeah.
That was the last season in which pitchers pitched from a distance of 45 feet. The distance was moved to 50 feet until 1893, in which it was during which it was moved to the modern distance of 60 feet 6 inches. So
in perspective, I believe 45 feet is about Little League range right now, isn't it?
Yes. And it also is a girls' softball distance, I think. High school, I'm talking about. I think maybe they're 40. I bet through the miracle of Google, Chris could come up with that. He's got, for those big old catcher's mitt hands he's got, he's pretty nimble on the keyboard. But anyway, I thought that was interesting. 0.86, that'll never be touched. But again, it was back in the. We're going back to the beginnings of baseball.
43 feet, Alan Buck.
43, okay, 43. I didn't think 45 sounded right, but that's pretty impressive. I still am amazed at what women can do hitting a ball thrown.
And for like 12
feet.
And under, it's 40. It's 40 feet for 12 and under.
Yeah.
In women's fast pitch.
The English and the curvature, curving that the girls can put on the balls, it's just amazing they can hit it like they do. I'm fascinated with the game and love it. And I used to look down my nose at women's sports until I began broadcasting girls softball, and I'm a huge, huge fan. So I had to get out of my rocking chair there for a moment and not you know, I had to accept that something new. And it was very good. Let's look at 1911, January 1st. Hyman Greenberg, later changed his name to Henry Benjamin Greenberg, a.k.a. Hank Greenberg. Now everybody knows who I'm talking about. Major League Baseball Hall of Fame, 1956. He was one of the greatest sluggers in Major League Baseball history. You can read all about him, but just in a nutshell, five-time All-Star, two-time World Series champ, two-time American League MVP. He played for Detroit. four-time American League home run leader and four-time American League RBI leader. He did all of this despite a 47-month military commitment, all of which took place during the prime of Greenberg's career. So there you go. I did not realize that he spent 4 years out of the military, as did famously Ted Williams. Was another one. I guess you could say that Greenberg belongs in our ones who came before department, as he was the first Jewish superstar in American team sports. He really was. That was, wow. You know, that was incredible what he did. And of course, Sandy Koufax, you know, came later, but I'm sure he would tip his cap to Hank Greenberg as well. For you hockey fans, January 3rd, 1939 marks the birth date of Bobby Hull. Hockey Hall of Fame 1983, nicknamed the Golden Jet because of his speed skating as well as his high-velocity shot-making ability. He won the Hart Memorial Trophy twice. That's the MVP trophy. The Art Ross Trophy, which is the leading scorer in hockey, won that three times. Stanley Cup winner with the Blackhawks in 1961, and he led the NHL in goals seven times. That's pretty impressive. He was named one of the 100 greatest NHL players in history.
Hmm.
Now we're all over the map today, folks, but we're just looking at birth dates. January 3rd, 1969, we're going to Formula One auto racing with Michael Schumacher. He's a retired Formula One race car driver. You've heard of him. During his 19-year driving career, he won the World Drivers' Championship title seven times. Okay? 1994, 95, 2000, 2001, 2, 3, and 4. Can you imagine winning seven road racing championships in a 19-year career? That's one every three, better than one every 3 years, and he did it 5 years in a row. Hats off to Michael Schumacher. That's very impressive. And, you know, thankfully he walked away when he's, you know, still alive and with us and capable, you know, I mean, that's always the goal. Now, a special January the 4th tribute, the birth date in 1930 of one Don Shula. We lost him last year, but he was the winningest head coach in NFL history with 347 wins, 328 in the regular season. I probably could have Chris just quote this all off of memory. He's a huge Dolphins fan. That's why I said this was a very special birth date. His career record, and this is impressive, 347, 173, and 6. In his 26-year head coach of the Dolphins that was his total career. He spent 26 years with the Dolphins, 33 total years. Some of those were with the Colts, and was he maybe with the Browns a year before that, or was he all? Did he start with the Colts?
Colts. He was an assistant, but yeah, it's still impressive.
Head coach, Colts and Dolphins.
And I think that, you know, there's going to be a time when I think the closest one to him is Belichick. And but, you know, if this year is indicative of what the future looks like for the Patriots, that record might be safe for a while.
Well, in off top of your head, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I do that, repeatedly. In his 33-year career, how many losing seasons did he have? Do you happen to know that by any chance?
I think it's one or two.
You are correct. It is two. It is two. And I didn't write down specifically when those. Oh, that's just kind of an aside. But that's an amazing thing, folks. 33 years, only two losing seasons in the world of professional football. Hall of Fame 1997, and as everyone knows, his 1972 Dolphins team is the only team to finish the season with a perfect record of 14-0. Which brings us to the subject, why didn't Kansas City sign Eli Manning for a short-term, a 10-day contract to play the Super Bowl and beat Tom Brady again? But I digress. Sorry, just threw that one out. January 6, 1920, Early Wynn Jr. He died in 1999. I didn't realize he lived that long, but Major League Hall of Fame in 1972, in baseball. He signed with the Washington Senators at age 17, leaving high school to pursue a professional baseball career. It might be considered a bit risky, to say the least, to quit high school and take the leap into the unknown abyss of a professional sport. But Wynn did okay for himself. He was known as one of the most intimidating pitchers of his time. He had a powerful fastball. Here, this is, I paraphrase this, but here's the words that came from what I found about him. He had a powerful fastball and a nasty attitude toward hitters. Wynn enjoyed a 23-year career, including being selected as a 9-time All-Star, led the league in wins twice, American League strikeout leader twice, and a Cy Young Award winner. So happy birthday, early Wynn. Could you imagine a powerful fastball and a nasty attitude coming at you from the hill? Here's another one. We're going back to tennis. It's rare that we have this much tennis, but this is very, very good here. 1936, Darlene Ruth Hard. She was in the International Tennis Hall of Fame in 1973, and I included her in this show because I'd never heard of her, and her accomplishments in the world of professional tennis certainly are noteworthy. She won just 3 Grand Slam singles titles, the French Open and the U.S. Open in 1960, and the U.S. Open again in 1961. She also won 14 Grand Slam doubles titles. Those were singles, giving her a combined 17 career Grand Slam titles. My IQ went up when I read about Darlene Ruth Hurd, who is still with us at age 85. So 17 career Grand Slams, pretty huge number. I know it's been surpassed now by several, but that was pretty strong. Here's another favorite of the show. Also January 6th, 1937, Lou Holtz, College Football Hall of Fame 2008. He's a well-known former college football coach at a number of major football programs, including Notre Dame, where he led the Fighting Irish to the 1988 National Championship. He's a football analyst and a very popular motivational speaker, which a lot of coaches can kind of go into that because that's basically, you know, what life's all about and what football's all, or sports is all about. Holtz has a great sense of humor in a rather understated sort of way. And when I searched information on him, I found numerous quotes that have been added to our quips and quotes department for use on later shows. And we have quoted him quite often on this show. But here's one to wet your whistle. Here's a quote from Lou Holtz. When all is said and done, more is said than done. Can't argue with that, can you, Chris?
No, you can't. He pretty much sums it up right there.
He does, and he does it in kind of a left-handed sort of way that catches you off guard. Well, let's jump back over to women's sports now, this time in golf, with the 1957 birth, January 6th also, of Nancy Marie Lopez. She was the World Golf Hall of Fame 1987. During her first full season on the LPGA Tour 1978, she won the VARE trophy, or is it VARE? V-A-R-E. I'm sorry. It might even be VARE. I apologize. I should have looked that up. For lowest scoring average. She was the LPGA Rookie of the Year, the LPGA Player of the Year, and was named the Associated Press Female Athlete of the Year. So 1978 was the year she burst onto the scene at age 21. She currently resides in the Villages, Florida, where she hosts an annual golf tournament to benefit the charity AIM, Adventures in Movement, which is an organization that helps mentally challenged, visually impaired, hearing impaired, physically handicapped, and other children and adults with special needs. She has hosted the tournament since 1981, and also serves as national ambassador with AIM, along with Baseball Hall of Famer Joe Morgan. So it's nice to hear of an athlete really giving back in retirement, but, you know, she started giving back 3 years after she burst onto the LPGA. So good for Nancy Lopez. That's terrific. I've got to I'm including a gentleman, January 7th, 1922, the birth date of Alvin Dark. Not anything extraordinary with his numbers. He was certainly a good baseball manager, but there's a hilarious story. We've told it before here on Game Day IQ. We're going to revisit this. Alvin Dark was a former Major League Baseball player and manager. And here's the story. He was managing the San Francisco Giants in the early 60s while Gaylord Perry was on the staff as a pitcher. And this was prior to the advent of the DH rule, so Perry had plenty of opportunities at the plate. And the word opportunity might be a bit generous here, maybe even a misnomer. Perry was a terrific pitcher, Hall of Fame 1991, so his prowess at the plate was a non-factor. When back in those days, for those of you who aren't as familiar, the pitcher batting was basically a throwaway. I mean, if it was a really strong pitcher, the fact that he was an automatic out in the lineup was insignificant. Well, one day in 1964 during batting practice, Perry was swatting home runs. He inspired Alvin Dark to say, quote, "Mark my words, a man will land on the moon before Gaylord Perry hits a home run." That's the end of the quote. Now let's fast forward 5 years to July 20th, 1969. Gaylord Perry was set to start against the Los Angeles Dodgers in a Sunday afternoon game. Start time, 1 o'clock Pacific time. At 1:17 Pacific time, Apollo 11 landed on the moon. In the top of the third, somewhere around 1:45 Pacific time, Gaylord Perry hit his first career home run, making Alvin Dark's offhanded comment from way back in 1964 rather prophetic.
Wow.
I just love that story, don't you?
That's the first time I've heard that one.
Yeah, what a coincidence it was the same day. I mean, you know, it could have been later on in July, could have been in August, who knows, but it was the exact same day and just a half hour apart, roughly. But, okay, we'll go back to football. January 9th, Bart Starr, born in 1934, passed away in 2019, Pro Football Hall of Fame 1977. He was the MVP in the first two Super Bowls. You know, books and books and books written about that man, so we don't go into it a whole lot here. But, you know, somebody like that, you can't skip over, you know, the first two Super Bowl MVPs without mentioning him. So maybe you share a birth date with him. And 1965, Tyrone Curtis Bogues. Everybody knows him as Muggsy. Former NBA player. He enjoyed, this is what's unbelievable to me, he enjoyed a 14-year career from 1987 to 2001. He was the shortest player in NBA history at 5'3". When he first burst onto the scene, I thought, well, hey, he was, you know, kind of a flash in the pan, a gimmick, very interesting, but isn't going to last. 14 years later, I had to change my opinion, didn't I? But yeah. I'm betting that record, that's a height record that will never be broken as the shortest player in history in the NBA. Here's another one that, Chris, I'm not sure if you would be familiar, maybe in the latter part of his career. January 10th, 1920, Max Patkin, does that name ring a bell?
Isn't he a boxer?
The Clown Prince of Baseball.
Oh,
you're thinking you combine Max Baer with something else. But yeah, Clown Prince of Baseball. Younger people might remember his appearance in the 1988 hit movie Bull Durham.
Okay. I know who you're talking about then after you mentioned the classic Bull Durham movie.
Yeah, there you go. And do you know what the impetus was behind his clowning career?
No.
He was a minor league baseball player when an arm injury derailed that option. He joined the Navy, and while pitching for a service team in 1944, this people, your game day IQ is about to go up. So his arm injury, you know, he goes into the Navy. He's pitching for a service team in 1944. Joe DiMaggio hit a home run off of Patkin. Well, in mock anger, Patkin threw his glove down and then followed DiMaggio around the bases, much to the delight of the fans, as they hooted and hollered and laughed. And a career was born for Max Patkin, the Clown Prince of Baseball. He entertained many, many kids, including this one. I was probably more in my adulthood when I really got familiar with him, but he was funny. But here's another person who impacted sports as they stand today. January the 11th, 1957, Darryl Dawkins, who passed away in 2015. Dawkins was a 6'11", 251-pound center. That was before the buffet, folks. in the NBA. In 1979, Dawkins shattered two backboards with thunderous dunks. That led to the NBA installing spring-loaded rims in all of its stadia. Here's something you probably don't know about the man whom Stevie Wonder nicknamed Chocolate Thunder, which I didn't know Stevie Wonder was the one that gave him the nickname Chocolate Thunder. Dawkins is the leader in personal fouls in a single NBA season, twice. In other words, he holds the top two spots on the single season foul list. He has, in 82-83, he had 379, and in 83-84, he had 386. He broke the record set in 1981-82 by then rookie Steve Johnson, who had 372. So Dawkins is on the, if you look up career, or excuse me, single season NBA fouls, Daryl Dawkins holds the top two spots. So there you go. But actually, you know, after the rims went in the pros, they then went into colleges and now in high schools. And so he did revolutionize the game, and they're in backyards all over the place. We had spring-loaded rims when I worked at Escalade Sports. So there you go. He really impacted his sport, maybe, well, eventually in a positive way. At the time, it was a little bit cumbersome, but it's okay. How about January 12, 1944? The birth date of Joseph William Smokin' Joe Frazier, passed away in 2011. Former heavyweight boxing champion. He won a gold medal in the 1964 Olympics. Reigned as the undisputed heavyweight champion from 1970 to 1973. He was the first man to defeat Muhammad Ali in the fight of the century in 1971. I'm reminded of one of the best and funniest lines I've ever heard from a sports broadcaster. You all might remember Howard Cosell's classic line during a 1973 fight between Joe Frazier and George Foreman. After Foreman knocked down Frazier, Cosell said in that unmistakable Cosell speech pattern, "Down goes Frazier." That was one of his most famous lines in all of sports. Well, fast forward to 2009 to 2014. Penn State had a point guard on his basketball team named Tim Frazier. And in a game at IU, there was a loose ball with players on both teams diving for it. And the announcer, as cool as could be, says, "I got to say it, folks, down goes Frazier." I still laugh about that one. And I'm sure I tried to look it up. I could not find the announcer who said that from that time, but I still remember it quite vividly. But anyway, so Joe Frazier, January 12th, if anybody celebrates a birthday with him, here's another one from January. Lincoln? Oh, from our history major, Chris Cook. There you go.
Abraham Lincoln, February 12th. 1809, I believe, was when he was born.
All righty. Here's another one. It's going to raise your game day IQ, folks. Born in January 12, 1960, Jacques Dominique Wilkins, retired NBA player. Do you know where Wilkins was born?
No.
Paris, France. Paris, France, while his father was stationed there with the U.S. Air Force. Hence the name Jacques Dominique Wilkins. So be honest, your game day IQ just went up with that one, didn't it?
Absolutely.
That's let's see. Yeah, I mean, I don't mean to sound, racist or anything like that, but how many Dominiques, Dominique Dawes, she's a female, but how many men Dominiques do you know outside of being born in France? And Jacques Dominique to start, to begin with. So that was pretty cool to find out that. And it was, his father was stationed there with the Air Force. How about January 15th, 1979? Drew Christopher Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, and I'm not going to go into his lengthy list of accomplishments. I am going to mention the one that, without it, none of the others would have occurred. Brees is 6 feet tall, weighs 290 pounds, 209. As a junior in high school, he blew out a knee, causing recruiters to shy away from him. Plus, with his size, he was too small to play major college football, right? He received scholarships from Kentucky and Purdue. He chose Purdue for its academics and stayed to complete his course study instead of leaving early, which he could have done at that point. He set many records at Purdue, and he continued to do the same in the NFL. So not bad for a little guy who wouldn't be able to compete because of his size. January 16th, 1935, Anthony Joseph A.J. Foyt, Jr., first man to win Indy 500 four times, since been joined by Al Unser and Rick Mears. Also January 16th, 1953, Tom Buck, my older brother. And in 1975, Chris Cook, the other man on the line here tonight, the podcast.
1976.
76. I'm sorry. You know what? I subtracted 45 from 2021 and got 75. And I was a math major, folks. We just celebrate greatness here on Game Day IQ, so I had to
Absolutely.
Throw those two in.
I appreciate that.
Uh-huh. Now, January 17th, and I did not know that these two gentlemen were born within a week of one another. January 17th, not same year, but dates. January 17, 1942, Cassius Marcellus Clay, Jr., passed away in 2016, heavyweight boxing champion boxer, changed his name to Muhammad Ali, known as the greatest. He burst onto the world stage in 1960 when he won a gold medal in the light heavyweight division in the Olympics. He was only 22 years old when he won the world heavyweight title from Sonny Liston in a huge upset victory. And I'm not going to go into detail on Ali's illustrious career. That would be a show unto itself and probably a two-parter. But maybe your birthday is January 17th, and now you know a famous person with whom you can share it. Here's one I'm throwing in. January the 18th, 1779. Peter Marc Roget passed away in 1869. Everybody's heard of Roget's thesaurus, a valuable tool for anyone who works using the English language in a professional context. Roget also invented the slide rule and the pocket chessboard. Not particularly sports related, but I ran across it and I found it interesting. So I
How do you go from inventing the slide rule to the pocket chessboard? That would be a conversation that I would love to have with that gentleman.
Well, yeah, kind of the three of them, the thesaurus, the slide rule, and the pocket chessboard, none of those really are related to one another. But I just found that interesting. And, the slide rule was used for many, many, many years by engineers all over. In fact, just last month, a friend of mine who works at Alcoa, and he posted a picture of a slide rule, and he said, here, post this if anybody knows what it is and how to use it. But, it's a thing of the past, obviously, but I just found that interesting, folks. Didn't mean to derail the sports show here. January 19th. Chris, if I were to ask you to name the first man to swim across the English Channel, could you do it? I don't think so, but in just a moment, you'll be able to.
Was he British?
He was born in 1848, and his name is Matthew Webb. He passed away in 1883, but he's first man to swim unassisted across the English Channel. That's a huge undertaking, a huge accomplishment. Not anything
26 miles at its most narrowest point, I believe.
Yes, something like that, yeah. And so he was 35 years old when he did it. That's just one of those incredible things that, if you can remember the name Matthew Webb, you just might win that barroom sports trivia contest. Let's jump to January 21st, 1940, Jack William Nicholas, the Golden Bear, retired professional golfer, won 117 professional tournaments, including 18 major titles. Again, an entire show and more could be dedicated to his career. Get on your computer and research the amazing things this man has done in his golf career. He's just incredible. Here's another one, January 21, 1963, Hakeem Olajuwon, retired NBA player from Nigeria, where he grew up playing soccer. So if anyone wonders where his great footwork and speed came from, look at his soccer past. Again, there's a multitude of information out about him, but the one thing I will give you is this. He is the answer to the question, when Michael Jordan was the number three pick in the 1984 draft, who was the number one pick? Hakeem Olajuwon.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's edification, does anybody know who number two was?
Michael
Kentucky
Jordan.
Player?
No. Jordan was three.
I bet you can picture him, but you can't call his name. Sam Bowie. Yep, Sam Bowie. But so when Michael Jordan was number three, Olajuwon was number one, and Bowie two. So there you go. That's another free game day IQ point. Here's one, January 25th, 1951, one of the greatest, Steve Prefontaine, passed away in 1975. He was an American long-distance runner from Oregon. He set American records at every distance from 2,000 meters to 10,000 meters. He, along with Jim Ryan, Frank Shorter, and Bill Rogers, helped fuel the 1970s running craze. Prefontaine died in a car accident at age 24. He one of the premier track meets in the world is the Prefontaine, and I'm sorry, I pronounce it different ways. It's either Prefontaine or Prefontaine, the Prefontaine Classic in Eugene, Oregon, in his honor. And I believe it's still going strong. Here's a fun one. January 26, 1934, Robert George Euchre, former Major League Baseball player dubbed Mr. Baseball by Johnny Carson. He's been announcing radio broadcasts of the Milwaukee Brewers since 1971, and many of you will remember him from the Miller Lite commercials when he sits in the wrong seat down in the box seats, and the usher removes him, and Euchre says, "Hey, I must be in the front row," and then he winds up in the nosebleed seats. It's pretty funny. Euchre is well known as being a comedian, often poking fun of his own rather lackluster baseball career. In 1967, he led the league in passed balls, though a lot of that could be attributed to the fact that he caught for the great knuckleballer Phil Niekro. And he often joked that the best way to catch a knuckleball was to wait until it stopped rolling and go pick it up. Perhaps the biggest highlight of Euchre's career was when he hit a home run off of future Hall of Famer Sandy Koufax, after which Euchre joked that he always thought that home run would keep Koufax from getting into the Hall of Fame. So Euchre has a great sense of humor. If you might pick up anything that he's written, it'll be humorous. He's a great man. And speaking of great, January 26, 1961, the birth date of hockey's the great one, Wayne Gretzky. Possibly the greatest hockey player the world has ever seen. His career in the WHA and the NHL is legendary. So, again, we won't go into it here because it would take up this entire show and one or two more. His career ended in 1999, after which he immediately was inducted into the NHL Hall of Fame. There was a three-year waiting period that could be waived, which it was in Gretzky's case. But after him, that option was revoked. His speed and skills had a profound effect in shaping the game of hockey as it is today. Excuse me. We are really hitting some upper echelon, top of the line athletes in the month of January. January 29th, 1960 was the birth date of Gregory Efthymios Louganis. Efthymios. Greg Louganis, recognized as probably the greatest diver in history. He won the silver medal in the 1976 Montreal Olympics in the 10-meter platform. Then the U.S. boycotted the 1980 games. Louganis came back to the 84 and 88 Olympics and swept both events, the 10-meter platform and the 3-meter springboard at both those Olympics. That's a pretty impressive thing to do. So his career, he participated in three Olympics, with the one in the heart of his career was boycotted, and he still swept both events
Didn't we boycott Russia's and they boycotted ours 4 years later?
Yeah. Basically, that was it. January 31, 1931. God bless America, folks. I'm sorry. January 31, 1913. Don Hutson, Hutson. He passed away in 1988. He's recognized as the first wide receiver in NFL history. He was a member of the NFL Hall of Fame inaugural class in 1963. Spent his entire 11-year career with the Green Bay Packers under Coach Curly Lambeau. Now listen to this. In his 11-year career, he led the league in receiving 7 times and in touchdowns 9 times. That is a standard of excellence to which all of us should aspire. 9 times in his 11 career, folks, he had the most touchdowns in the league. His number 14 was the first jersey retired by the Packers. So here's one. Chris, I guarantee your game day IQ will go up on this. I guarantee if we had to bet the ranch, I would bet it. The January 31st, 1914 birth date of Arnold Raymond Cream. He was a boxer that you've heard of. He was a professional boxer competing in 1930 to 1953 when he won the heavyweight title. In 1951 at age 37, he became the oldest man to win that title. And you know him best as Jersey Joe Walcott. I had never heard his birth name before. That's why I included the name, you know. And but at age 37, he was the oldest man to win the heavyweight title of the world at that time. That's since, of course, been revoked. Speaking of the cream of the crop, once again, the January 31st birth date in 1919 of Jack Roosevelt Robinson. Passed away in 1972, Major League Baseball Hall of Famer in 1962. That, of course, folks, is Jackie Robinson. He's the player who broke the color barrier in 1947, true champion in every sense of the word, not only for his excellence at his craft, but for the way he carried himself with class and dignity in the face of the racial resentment that he endured. And obviously, I'm going from everything that I had read. Didn't watch him compete. I wasn't born till 57, but he is in the wing of the ones who came before in the original company complex. His accomplishments could fill several shows too. So let's just wish Jackie Robinson a happy birthday on January the 31st. But you know, man, we are really, you know, you take several sports and we have picked the top one off of the sport with birth dates in January. Here's one for those from Chicago, 1931, Ernie Banks, passed away in 2015.
Maybe Mr. Cub?
That's exactly right, Chris, Mr. Cub. And here's what raised my game day IQ about Ernie Banks. He and his partner, Bob Nelson, owned a Ford dealership in Chicago and were the first blacks to own a Ford dealership. How about that? Or he should probably get a room in the or a picture at least hanging in the wing of the ones who came before. That was quite a thing, and that was back in the back when he was after his playing days and all. But that was pretty special. And now for one of my all time favorites, born in 1947, January 31st, Lynn Nolan Ryan Jr. I did not know his first name was Lynn. Major League Baseball Hall of Famer in 1999. He's the career strikeout leader with 5,714. And before, you know, young people think, well, yeah, but he pitched back then. Well, second on the list is Randy Johnson. Randy, the big unit, Johnson, at 4,875. So he's almost 900 behind Nolan Ryan. So put that in perspective. Nolan Ryan's 7 no-hitters is a record. Second on that list is Sandy Koufax with 4. So put that in perspective. And I just gave you those to show how incredible his accomplishments are. The rest, once again, as I've said several times this show, go to the baseball references and get his statistics because this is another guy who can take up an entire show. I will say this, though. One of the things, you know, his career, he went to, I think 46 was when he retired. He was one of the first Major League Baseball pitchers to recognize how important your legs are. And he would, after his performances, he would ride an exercise bike to get rid of the lactic acid buildup in the leg muscles. He got kept his legs in very good shape while he was pitching. But he also, in his early 20s, and everybody knows about pitchers who start fireballing it at age 19 and 20 in the big leagues, and they're blown up by 25. His control was so bad in his early years, he didn't start pitching a significant number of innings until he was about 27 or 28 years old. And the male physique, men mature again in their late 20s. Their musculature has another developmental stage. That's why a lot of times you'll see heavy weightlifters, they're in their 30s, and they're going strong, and they're doing great. That's, of course, Chris, if they have good knees, if they have all the cartilage in their knees. But that's one of the things that Nolan Ryan kept his arm in such good shape. He didn't tear it up in his early 20s because he couldn't throw the ball over the plate. So he'd get a few innings, and then he'd be out. And then, you know, his career started late. So you could research that. It's very, very interesting. But that, I think, brings us to the end of our information for this week. But I got a quote here that, Chris, I know you will love this quote. It's, again, from one of the cream of the crop. Here's the quote. One man can be a crucial ingredient on a team, but one man cannot make a team. That is from the leading scorer in the history of the NBA.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar?
Absolutely. Isn't that pretty good? One man can be a crucial ingredient on a team, but one man cannot make a team. So there you have it from the guy that could say, hey, you know, I scored all these points. No, he recognized it was all about the team. So anyway, I think I tell you, we've already started working on our next show. There's a terrific story that I knew, and when I reheard it, and it triggered some bells in the back of my memory. And I thought, yep, I'm going to research that one. We're going to get that one on the show. It's a fun one. But with that, I don't have anything more today. Do you have anything you want to throw out, Chris?
You come up with
good historical stuff.
I just chimed in. You'd think that we prepared for today's show.
You know, we do. This one was one of those odd ones that it wasn't just also-rans. These people that we were talking about today are some of the very best of the best, and that's why I picked the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar quote to finish it out with, because he kind of icing on the cake there for the NBA fans. But with that, I'll turn it back to you, Chris, and say good night to all good sports.
And for Alan Buck, I'm Chris Cook. Thank you for listening to this week's edition of GameBIQ at thegrillingtruth.com.